This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, July 30th, 2021, on your public radio station, KUAF. We are a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead, it's beginning to feel like the summer of 2020. Governor Asa Hutchinson is declaring a statewide public health emergency, and there is discussion about pandemic-related unemployment benefits. We'll hear from the governor in about 4 minutes or so. And after that, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on a judge's decision that the state shouldn't have stopped pandemic unemployment aid from the federal government early. After Ozarks on Science Friday, global warming is increasing the severity of our disasters and how many communities they hit at once. Join Science Friday today to hear why one researcher says it's time to rethink our response system. Plus, what researchers are learning from Mars quakes. Science Friday starts at 1 this afternoon on KUAF. Arkansas's summer surge of COVID-19 is continuing. The Arkansas Department of Health reports more than 2,800 new cases diagnosed in the last 24 hours, with 11 newly reported deaths. Active cases increased by more than 1,400. Hospitalizations decreased by 9, though patients on ventilators around the state increased by a net of 10. For the second consecutive 24-hour period, there are 130 COVID-19 patients in hospitals in Northwest Arkansas. A report from Northwest Arkansas healthcare providers points out that from June 17th, when there were 24 COVID-19 patients in Northwest Arkansas, to July 10th, when the number of patients was 48, it took 23 days to double the number of people with the virus in hospitals in Benton and Washington counties. Then it took only 15 days for that number to double on July 25th, and the current number of 130 patients represents a 442% increase since June 17th. The Fayetteville School Board would like to require masks this upcoming school year. During last night's meeting, the board voted unanimously to pass a resolution stating that if they were not prohibited by Act 1002, they would be enforcing a mask mandate in all public K-12 schools in the district. School Board President Nika Waitzman says the language in the resolution is meant to send a message to the Arkansas legislature that schools should have the local autonomy to decide what is best for their students. The school board clarified that if Act 1002 is amended or appealed, they would need to call a special meeting to officially pass a mask mandate. Yesterday, Governor Asa Hutchinson called for a special session to look at Act 1002. We'll hear more about that in just a moment. And Governor Asa Hutchinson is calling for more collaboration between government and private sector businesses to help respond to and prevent cybersecurity threats. The governor spoke alongside fellow Republican Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland and Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana in a cybersecurity summit held yesterday. Governor Hutchinson says businesses and governments are often at the greatest risk for a cybersecurity threat. The governor says Arkansas's emphasis on computer science education will help boost the state's cybersecurity workforce. The Benton County Quorum Court is the second in Northwest Arkansas to declare its county a pro-life county. The non-binding measure passed last night. Earlier this month, the Washington County Quorum Court passed a similar measure. The Republican Party of Arkansas's chair, Janelle Fulmer, says she applauds the move and says Arkansas is the most pro-life state in the country. The measure passed last night in Bentonville, 13-1. Heat advisories are in effect for the entire listening area today and tomorrow. And then a chance of rain is in Sunday's forecast. This afternoon, highs will range from 95 to 100 across the region, with heat index readings as high as 106 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, sunshine with highs from 98 to 102, heat index values from 104 to 110. Then Sunday, a 60% chance of rain with highs from 87 to 94. This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas is again in an official public health emergency. Governor Asa Hutchinson made that declaration yesterday.
Anytime you're having staffing shortages in the hospital, whenever today we have, I believe it is, for COVID patients that are waiting in ambulances to be able to find a hospital to go to. That constitutes an emergency and a public health crisis. I'm also adopting this proclamation for a public health emergency for two specific reasons for actions. And one is for Adam to seek necessary staffing assistance in our health care programs across Arkansas through our interstate compact.
The governor says the emergency declaration will also allow for the easing of licensure for healthcare professionals.
For returning to the profession after they have retired, that they can reenter, or to speed entry into service. And we're looking at a number of different specific actions. I'm directing our Department of Health to take the steps necessary to ease that licensure even more so that we can increase our staffing in the hospitals and for those that are in need.
Governor Hutchinson says that emergency declaration is subject to review by a committee of the whole of the state legislature, but it is in effect right now. The governor says after a conversation with the White House this week, the federal government will send a surge response team to Arkansas. He says that that team can help the state analyze, strategize, and maximize current hospital space as more and more patients need medical attention. The governor is also calling a special session, likely next week, to address the recently enacted Act 1002. That act prohibits any school district in the state from implementing a mask mandate on its own.
Most likely next week to amend Act 1002 to give local school boards, local decision makers, the authority to make a decision for the public health of those that are 12 and under, or their entire school environment. But I'm particularly concerned about those that are in that age category. I have consulted with Speaker Shepard and Senate Pro Tem Hickey, and they have expressed to me that it's going to be a heavy lift to get passage of this in the legislature, but I have confidence that as the legislature looks at this, they will understand, one, that it's a conservative principle to utilize local decision making, and not everything fits statewide, and then secondly, that this is necessary really for providing local school boards the ability to protect those most vulnerable young people, 12 and under, as they go to school, and we all want to have school in that environment.
At his press conference this week, the governor recited statistics made public earlier in the week by Arkansas Children's in Little Rock. Those numbers show there are 24 children hospitalized there with the virus, half of whom are too young to receive a vaccination, and none of the young patients are fully immunized. And the governor stressed the special session will not be about a statewide mask mandate.
This is not about a debate about mask mandates for those that can make their own decisions and have means to get vaccinated. This is a discussion about the school environment where schools can make decisions to add to the public health for their own school environment and for the children that they have a responsibility to protect. There's no discussion about restrictions on business, mandates on businesses. We are wide open in Arkansas. We're going to be doing business in Arkansas. We've got to we have to live with the threat of the virus, the increase in vaccinations, but also we've got to continue to do business, provide for our families, and there's not going to be those kind of restrictions here in this state.
The Arkansas Department of Health reports, as of late yesterday, just more than 41% of Arkansans 12 and over are fully immunized, and about 11.5% of that eligible population is partially immunized. A Pulaski County Circuit Court judge is ruling to resume federal pandemic unemployment insurance compensation to nearly 70,000 qualified Arkansans. The emergency benefits were terminated by Governor Asa Hutchinson, who says jobs are plentiful in the state. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with the lead litigating attorney at Legal Aid of Arkansas, who filed the lawsuit on behalf of five Arkansas plaintiffs.
Governor Asa Hutchinson announced in early May plans to direct the Arkansas Division of Workforce Services to terminate federally funded pandemic jobless benefits after June 26th, impacting more than 69,000 eligible workers. More than 4.7 million U.S. workers in two dozen other GOP-controlled states also have had their emergency benefits slashed. Kevin DeLeban and his team at Legal Aid of Arkansas in West Memphis filed a lawsuit July 23rd in Pulaski County Circuit Court on behalf of five Arkansas plaintiffs against Hutchinson and Workforce Services, claiming unlawful exercise of executive authority, asking the court to reinstate the federal benefits.
The lawsuit itself is based on a state law where long ago the Arkansas General Assembly said that the Division of Workforce Services basically had to cooperate to the fullest extent and take any action necessary to secure to the citizens of the state all advantages available under federal unemployment laws. The governor's decision and Workforce Services' decision to terminate participation in the program violates that state law.
Circuit Court Judge Herb Wright held an emergency hearing Wednesday morning, ruling in favor of the plaintiffs.
The judge ruled that the state of Arkansas, the governor didn't have authority to terminate participation in the federal unemployment programs. And he's ordered the state to resume participation in those programs.
DeLeban says details post-ruling, like compensation for lost benefits if reapplication is required, have yet to be determined. Both Maryland and Indiana, he says, have also been ordered by courts to reinstate federal emergency jobless benefits. He says pandemic unemployment compensation is a lifeline for individuals, couples, and families.
And you can imagine the human suffering that it's caused. I mean, these are all people who've lost their main source of income. They've been looking for ways to replace it through work, don't have enough money to pay the rent, don't have enough money to pay mortgages, don't have enough money to get food, don't have enough money to keep the lights on in some cases, not enough money for medical bills. So all of kind of life's basic necessities have been imperiled by the state's decision to end these benefits.
Federal pandemic unemployment compensation was first conveyed by the Trump administration under the CARES Act, which all states opted into.
And that had three particular types of unemployment benefits that built on the pre-existing traditional unemployment system. So you had what was called federal pandemic unemployment compensation, or FPUC, that added $300 a week to whatever amount you would otherwise get. You had something called Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, or PEUC, which extended the amount of time you could get benefits under state law in Arkansas. Normally, that's 16 weeks. With this PEUC, it's much, much longer. And finally, the CARES Act expanded eligibility to people who weren't traditionally covered by UI. So this is people who are self-employed or gig workers or people who got a job somewhere recently, but then lost it before they had enough time to qualify for traditional unemployment.
Pandemic unemployment benefits are fully federally funded, including administrative costs. They're set to expire the first week of September, but because Arkansas in late June opted out.
So anybody who was receiving benefits then might have been eligible to receive 10 or 11 weeks more, and they've lost out on that opportunity.
In a statement issued in early May announcing his intentions, Governor Hutchinson says pandemic unemployment benefits were critical during mass layoffs when jobs were scarce. But now he says jobs are plentiful and workers are scarce, which DeLeban refutes.
What many people don't understand about unemployment is that you have to be looking for work. And that's true of these new programs. You have to be looking for work. You have to report what efforts you've made to look for work. And you can't receive the benefits if you refuse an offer of employment. And so it simply doesn't make any sense that cutting off benefits of these kind is going to force people back to work. They're already looking for work. They can't receive benefits unless they look for work, and they have to accept work when it's offered.
DeLeban says the value of the reinstated benefits is estimated to be over $30 million a week.
They bring hundreds of millions of dollars to the state economy.
At a press conference yesterday, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson says he expects the state attorney general will appeal the circuit court ruling to the Arkansas Supreme Court. Meanwhile, with pandemic unemployment compensation scheduled to end September 6th for everyone and the aggressive spread of the COVID-19 Delta variant impacting workers and businesses, there's discussion about the emergency work benefit entitlement being extended into 2022. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
In about 6 minutes on this Friday edition of Ozarks at Large, digging deeper into World War II. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth talks with Kathy Comfort, a professor of French at the University of Arkansas, about her book discussing Nazi occupation of France. The book, first published in 2018, is now available in paperback. And Ozarks at Large is available to you in many different ways, not just at noon and 7 on KUAF 91.3. You can also go to the new KUAF app and find the latest edition of our show. Just click on it, and you can hear it. You can ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large and hear the most recent daily edition of our show. You can also subscribe to our free podcast. It's available through KUAF.com and all of the major podcast distributors. And you can also subscribe to the KUAF Ozarks at Large daily email newsletter. That's free. You sign up at KUAF.com, and we send you every weekday afternoon a list of what was on the show that day, plus other information. And each of the listings has a link so you can directly listen to the show, the interview, or the piece that you'd like to listen to. It's all available for free, and much more information about all of those offers at KUAF.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Roots HQ on the Avenue series presents Rodney Crowell, Sunday, August 1st. Tickets, event schedule, and more information available online at FayettevilleRoots.org. Ozark Guidance, an affiliate of Arisa Health, is a nonprofit behavioral health center focused on better mental health. Arisa Health has announced several positive changes to its employee compensation and benefits that are designed to help the organization recruit, engage, retain, and invest in its workforce. ArisaHealth.org/employment for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Oklahoma State Department of Health is updating its daily count of new COVID-19 cases. The most recent 24 hours of testing revealed 1,777 new cases and 8 newly reported deaths. It's the third consecutive day Oklahoma has recorded more than 1,400 new cases. The Arkansas Department of Human Services is wanting children in the foster care program and young people up to age 26 who were in the foster care program in Arkansas to know there is a one-time pandemic-related payment available for them. This morning, we reached out to Amy Webb, the Chief of Communications and Community Engagement at the department, about the funds. She says it makes sense.
Even on a good day when there's no pandemic, it is hard to transition from foster care into being an adult on your own. So they know that the pandemic just made it harder for these youth and young adults who are transitioning out of foster care. And so this is just an effort to kind of give them a steady, stable state, give them a little financial support to make it through.
How does it work? How does one apply for this?
So they go on our website, and it's just a simple form that they need to fill out. There are a couple of eligibility requirements. So they have to be youth or young adults. So if they were in foster care anytime from age 16 to age 21, and they are currently age 16 to 26, then they're eligible. So they just need to go on and fill out the application, and then our folks will verify the information, make sure it's accurate, and then payment should go out by September 30th. And it's important to note that they go directly to the youth or young adult, and the kids did not have to age out of foster care to be eligible.
And there is a deadline for application.
There is a deadline for applications. It's August 31st. And we think that there's about 4,000 young adults and teens who are eligible. And honestly, we hope to get all 4,000 of those. So we are encouraging people to spread the message because we know that these teens probably could use the help, and we want to do what we can to help them. So it's going to be at least $750. And really, the amount depends on the number of people who apply. We have a set pot of money, and we'll just divvy it up among the people who apply. But this is a one-time thing. So after this deadline of August 31st, the money will no longer be available. So we need people to act now.
And I want to touch on something else you had mentioned. You want to spread the word because you said there are 4,000 eligible and you want them all to benefit. One reason you need to spread the word is because you aren't necessarily in contact with all 4,000 of them.
Correct. So there are some that we are in contact with because they may still be in foster care. Because in Arkansas, you can remain in foster care until the age of 21. But there are older young adults, you know, up to the age of 26, who we are not in contact with anymore. We don't have their addresses. So we really want to reach those folks and make sure they know about this opportunity.
Amy Webb is the Chief of Communications and Community Engagement at the Arkansas Department of Human Services. She spoke with us this morning about money available for many young people currently in or formerly in the Arkansas Foster Care Program who are eligible for one-time payments. For more information, ar.gov/foster care payments.
On this week's On the Media, new reporting on the FBI's role in breaking up the plot to kidnap Michigan's governor spotlights the earlier, more credulous coverage.
It was a really big story, and we were all frantic to cover it, and we were receiving sort of direct into the vein what the federal prosecutors were telling us.
On the next On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, Sunday morning at 11 on KUAF. This month, University of Arkansas professor Kathy Comfort republished her 2018 book, Refiguring Les Années Noires, Literary Representations of the Nazi Occupation. Comfort, a professor of French, spoke with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth recently about revisiting the collection of literary reviews and why the topic feels even more timely for readers today.
So, Dr. Comfort, can you tell me a little bit about your book, Refiguring Les Années Noires, how you came to this topic and why you decided to do this collection?
Actually, I'm a 20th century novel specialist, and I taught a graduate course. I taught one of the books that really interested me, and it was about a first-person novel about a person who had collaborated with the Nazis, and it was written by a person who had been deported to a concentration camp in Germany for being part of the resistance. And it was interesting to me because he took the point of view of a collaborator in his first-person narration, and I just thought it was really interesting. So that's kind of how I got started on it.
Yeah, and I think when we think about the occupation or even about World War II in France, we maybe don't even think about the occupation that much, and especially from some of the perspectives that you explore, like the Roma perspective and then the perspective of the French resistance. Can you talk about why you wanted to explore those different perspectives and some that maybe aren't seen very often?
I think for me, it's the more I did research into the memoirs and the novels based on the occupation, I just got interested in the different perspectives that we don't hear about. And as you said, there's a lot of sort of superficial ideas about the resistance and about France under Nazi occupation. And I just was interested in sort of the groups whose voices have been sort of silenced over the years. And the Roma one especially, I was very interested in that because it's not something people have talked about in France. It's only been the last 15 years, pretty much, that people have acknowledged that, that there were internment camps for Roma in southern France.
And what does that conversation look like today as people are starting to talk more about it? And how is it being brought up in French society?
I think that officially, they've recognized it, and I think that there's sort of a, well, obviously a feeling of shame, but it's also tied into sort of the Roma treatment in France today. In certain respects, it's still sort of, they're a marginalized group, and there are a lot of prejudice against them. And I think that sort of just sort of ties into the internment camps They actually had internment camps during World War I as well, because a lot of the Roma were nomadic people, so they would cross the border between France and Germany. And so a lot of people are afraid that they were spies during World War I. Yeah. So it's a complicated issue, and I think that it's something that the European Union has been working on, and they've made a lot of progress addressing the issues of the prejudice against the Roma.
And then when you were compiling the literature for this book, how did you go about deciding what to choose, or maybe what to leave out, or what you felt was important to include and why?
I read a lot of primary works, a lot of novels and a lot of memoirs, and since I'm a literary critic, basically, I was interested in the way that they portray the occupation and the way that they the images that they use. For me, that's very interesting. In the case of the Roma novel, Les Septième Filles, he uses sort of an allegory of a folktale, a witch, a Roma. Well, they call it a witch in English, but it's from her perspective, and she sort of embodies the Roma people because she's persecuted as well. And for the other ones, one of the threads that I didn't expect to find was the references to Proust and À la recherche du temps perdu. And it makes sense because it was, you know, Proust is such a big figure in literature. But a lot of people did references to Proust, allusions, and sometimes they sort of did a variation on especially the famous Madeleine episode. So for me, that was interesting too, the sort of intertextual references.
And then did this, reading all of these and then compiling it and doing the reviews, did it change your perspective on the occupation in France at the time?
Yeah, because I think I had never really thought about the average person's experience. You always think of black and white, Nazi versus resistance. And reading the resistance memoirs are really interesting. But it's also interesting to read about the people who collaborated. And especially I was interested in the children of collaborators who wrote their memoirs. And one in particular, Le Rivalement de ma mémoire, talks about a woman who's dealing with her father having been a collaborator, and he was assassinated by the resistance when she was 8 years old. And her mother was German, so she had sort of a double problem dealing with it, and only came to terms with it in the late 1960s, so, you know, almost 30 years after the fact.
Can you talk about how that time period and then the literature coming out of it has affected or still plays out in French society today?
Yeah, they're in popular culture, certainly there's a lot of references to the occupation. One of my other research interests is French crime fiction, and they've adapted a lot of the events from the Nazi occupation, like the rounding up of the Jewish population of Paris. So since influenced that, in France, the bande dessinée, the comic, graphic novels, I guess, in English, a lot of them deal with the Nazi occupation and sort of try to delve into the experience of marginalized populations. And there's still movies coming out about the occupation, and more and more they're dealing with the sort of the French reaction to it, because there's a lot of people say that there are more people in the resistance after the war trying to cover up what they did. And the reasons for collaborating were very complex as well. Everybody has a different reason for collaborating. A lot of times it's just to survive. Films and novels, I think, in contemporary France are starting to deal with those aspects as well.
And when you look at, you know, novels and literature in France today, since that's one of your interests, and how does it differ from English language or sort of mainstream novels that we maybe come to know about more often?
In the United States, I think it's changing a little bit, but I think the French are interested in the individual, and there's a lot less of the sort of heroic narratives that we see in American movies and novels, I think. And I think they really want to capture what it was like, the environment. And, you know, Americans sort of like the heroic war stories, I think.
Yeah. And then for modern audiences and people who maybe are reading the book today, or for some of your students who may read the book, mm-hmm. What can they take away from it? What can a modern viewer take away from these stories, this literature?
I think it's interesting to me because there's a lot of issues that are still going on for us. I think immediately of the Afghanistan situation with the U.S. military there in Iraq, but also just sort of the impact that war has on civilian populations. And to me, that's really interesting. I'm interested in the individual stories and giving them a voice. And I think that's sort of something that we forget about. We see on news reports, you know, the attacks and the battles even far away. And we forget about a lot of times the civilian population and how it affects them.
Yeah. And was there one or a couple specific stories that you read that you felt was interesting or significant or unusual, in your opinion, that you came out of this collection with?
I think that the ones that I thought were different, the resistance, the woman resistance fighter, the Annie Gaino novel was interesting because she sort of fell into being a part of the resistance. It wasn't really an active thing, but once she was in, she was totally devoted, and she was interrogated by the Nazis for months, the Gestapo. And I thought that was very interesting how she coped with being in prison, being interrogated by the enemy. And also I was also touched by I have a chapter on Charlotte Delbo, who was in the resistance and who was deported to Auschwitz. And she was one of the very few survivors from the convoy that left France. She was a Communist Party member, and so she was a target of that. And for me, it was interesting to see how she told her story in a literary way with allusions to the French classic authors. And she worked with a playwright and was an actress, so she knew the French canon very well for theater. And so she integrated that into her story, and it's sort of a way to distance, I suppose, from the trauma of being in Auschwitz and being surrounded by death.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then for Americans and for, you know, people in Arkansas, for us here, this seems so far removed from our daily life and from what's happening now. And I'm just wondering, you know, what after, because it's a republish, it came out in 2018, mm-hmm. and it's in paperback now. Mm-hmm. So after reflecting on it here this year, you know, what can American audiences or people in Arkansas take away from this?
I think it's, for me, I tried to get a diversity of experiences. And for me, it's important to see how other people interpret trauma. Because I think, obviously, everybody has traumatic experiences, but for me, it's how you process the trauma that's important. And I think that it sounds sort of strange, but I think it's sort of comforting to see that people can go through such horrible things and make it through. It's sort of, you know, the human spirit that really touches me, I think. And I think it's important for us to remember the individuals, as I keep going back to that point, but for me it's really important to sort of go beyond the official narrative that the government, especially in France, had for 30 years after the war, and dig deeper. I think that's the takeaway, I think, is to, if you're interested in something, to dig deeper. And I think that's something that everybody can take away, and view other people's perspectives.
Yeah, and coming out of, you know, I'm sure you spent a lot of time reflecting on this during the pandemic, and having it be republished. Was there anything that changed about it this past year for you about how you saw it or interpreted the literature?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of us have experienced the trauma of the pandemic, and I think that again, it's the individual reaction and how we handle things, how we process the trauma. And I sort of think that there are parallels between living through an occupation, an enemy occupation, and being affected by the pandemic. Yeah, it's all about processing, I think, the trauma.
Right. Yeah. And then moving away from the book a little bit, you work at the university, and you usually go on the study abroad trips, yes?
Yeah.
So the past 2 years, I guess, you haven't been able to go to France. How has that been, not being able to go back to this place that's so important to your work and to your academic life?
Yeah, it's very frustrating, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way, that the travel is just impossible, and it's really not in the foreseeable future, yeah. I think. You know, it's going to be a while before we can before I can go back to France. But the amazing thing is that a lot of the French resources that I use a lot of archival materials and things from the French National Library, the Bibliothèque Nationale. A lot of those things are online, and I've been working with some of the librarians there who have digitalized some of the things that I need. So it's been really a good experience to sort of make connections that I probably wouldn't have made in person.
Yeah, I guess that is kind of one small perk from all of this.
Yeah.
All right. Was there anything else that you'd like to add or say, or you think people should know?
I don't think so. I think, I think the thing that really is interesting to me, and I think it would be for readers too, is just the sort of individual voice that we don't really see in popular or even historical, popular representations or in historical accounts. Yeah. And to me, I think that's really fascinating.
Right. Thanks for talking to me, Dr. Comfort. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Daniel.
That was University of Arkansas French professor Kathy Comfort speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth about her book, Refiguring Les Années Noires, Literary Representations for the Nazi Occupation. It's now out in paperback from Lexington Books. This is Ozarks at Large.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the Square in downtown Bentonville. The museum is pleased to present Live at the Five and Dime, free, family-friendly concerts on the Square Thursdays from 5 to 7 p.m. WalmartMuseum.com for more information. Roots HQ on the Avenue series presents Daryl Scott Friday and Saturday, July 30th and 31st. Tickets, event schedule, and information available online at FayettevilleRoots.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from her home office in Bella Vista is Becca Martin Brown, who is the features editor for the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Becca, welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
Do you remember way back in the day when we first adopted our daughter? Not you and I, my daughter's father and I.
Yes, I do.
That I used to say, I don't have time for any of this.
Yes.
Well, there's a new puppy in my house.
And?
I don't have time for any of this.
Well, let's talk about what is happening, or as much of it as we can fit into our time here.
All right. Well, first of all, one of my favorite times of year is season announcements. You know that.
Yeah, I do.
And the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas has announced their season for 21-22. And like the Fort Smith Symphony, they say they learned some things during the pandemic, including how to interact with their audience through things like live streaming and virtual and online programming. So that's going to continue. There will be things that happen like the little personal concerts that they did online that will continue to happen. But they also have a full season scheduled starting November 5th at the Walton Arts Center. It starts with Mozart and Beethoven. Then in December 11th, A Very Sona Christmas. December 12th is The Snowman, the family concert with the screening of The Snowman. January 22nd is a new work that will be premiered in Northwest Arkansas, and that'll be exciting. It's called Phoenix Ascending.
Then in February, they have somebody coming that plays the tabla.
A double-headed drum.
That is very much a part of Indian music from the country of India.
Right, right.
And so that'll be fun. And I love those sorts of things. And then in April, they'll be playing Mahler.
Oh, boy.
That ought to wake everybody up.
Exactly.
Season tickets are on sale right now, starting at $161. And then single tickets go on sale in mid-August. And you can find out more about all of that in this Sunday's What's Up and at sonamusic.org. If you want to get out Sunday afternoon, the Mountain Street Stage Series is over at the Fayetteville Public Library.
That's a sign that summer is, you know, maybe more gone than here.
But I actually have two alternatives. One is the Northwest Arkansas Audio Theater production of an original script called What Alice Knows in a Book or No Place Like Tome.
Okay.
Here's the principle. It's written by Eden Miller, who we grew up knowing as Eden Tambulian.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is that what if Lewis Carroll couldn't be there to tell Alice stories? So he gathered up some stories for her to tell herself.
Okay, I'm interested.
So Alice pops into The Emperor's New Clothes by Hans Christian Andersen. How the Camel Got His Hump from the Just So Stories by Rudyard Kipling.
Okay.
The Tale of Peter Rabbit by Beatrix Potter. Peter and Wendy by James M. Barrie. And The Patchwork Girl of Oz by L. Frank Baum. And, of course, the audio theater is all done with voices and sound effects and so much fun. And actors taking multiple roles, which is always nice when you're trying to rehearse during a pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two performances. One is Saturday afternoon at the Fayetteville Public Library, but it's going to be sent out as a podcast. So you can go to faylib.org and hear that from home. And then at 2 o'clock on Sunday, they're performing live at 214 South Main Street in Springdale, the building formerly known as ACO, and tickets are $5 to $10 at the door. And also tonight, if you don't like anything else that we've suggested, the Summer of Spielberg Outdoor Film Series continues at Crystal Bridges with The Goonies.
The Goonies. All right.
Yeah. Showtime's 8:15, art making starts at 7:30, and it's free.
Well, get some rest, Becca. And we'll, if you can,
I'm gonna sleep under a dog later today.
And we will talk to you again next Friday. Is that a deal?
Absolutely.
Becca Martin.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.